round me out the business where the grapes of wrath are stored. He that rules the dead, commanding of his arrow of report. His rule is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Our God is marching on.
Yeah. die, I scarce can take it in, that on the cross my burden gladly bearing, he bled and died to take away my sin.
Then sings my soul, my Savior God to thee, how great thou art, how great thou art. Then sings my soul, my Savior God to thee, how great thou art.
Could see what I'm seeing. You're beautiful. I think we ought to give that choir another hand. Thank you, Peggy. Thank you, Tom. And thank you, choir, each and every one of you. It was beautiful. Liz, you did very well. Well, let's see. Next thing we do is eat. That's at 12 o'clock. And tapes are going to be ready over there. And each and every one of you have taken a part in this session, this retreat, or whatever you want to call it. But every spring, we try to give everybody a chance to say something. And you've all had this chance. And I know some of you have sat during these meetings when they were calling on people to talk. And your heart was pounding. And you wanted to get up, but you just couldn't make it for some reason or another. You know what that is when you're called on to talk and you're sitting there and your heart is pounding and you want to get up? That's victory drums. And those drums are beating in your heart, and God knows you wanted to, and God knows you had something good to say. And I know that you feel spiritual after hearing something like this. It sort of gets to you, don't it? And I know that we all have a great deal of thanks in our hearts for all the speakers that we've heard and all the people at the little separate talks that have come. And I'd like now for everybody who has participated in any way, if you've come up to the mic to talk at one of the call-up meetings, or if you have spoken at one of the meetings, or if you led one of the meetings, introduced the speaker, Red Hot Works of what? All of you who have taken part, please stand. Every one of you. Come on. Come on. Stand up. Stand up and be counted. Now I want to give you a hand. What?
Let's give a hand to those who listen.
Yeah. Yeah, they come next. Yeah, because you listen so good. Thank you, Elise. And thank you for that suggestion. And Elise is one of the ones that participated and didn't stand up. I can't think of anything else. My heart is so full, and I'm so full of thanks and gratitude. If I have missed recognizing anyone, I apologize. But I love you all and hope to see you back here next year. Yes, Tom? I didn't... Yes, how many people are here for the first time? Yeah. You know, if we didn't have a lot of first-timers every time, pretty soon we wouldn't have nobody. Because you know the only one that's here today that has been to every one of these spring sessions is Elise. Elise has been to every one of them. I had to miss one. Curly had to miss one. But Elise hadn't missed a one. Keep up the good work. And now, without any further hesitation, I want to introduce you to our fearless leader for this morning, Jerry.
Hi, everybody. I am Jerry Martin, a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I'm a member to Keep the Simple Group in Harbor Heights, Florida. And before we start getting into the meeting, I would like to express my gratitude to Charlie and the people who work with him to put this thing on for us. And I think they deserve the big hand. So how about it? And I'd also like to thank everybody for being here and making this weekend possible for me.
Lord, I've almost missed one of the main ones. I want to thank Lake Yale and all of the people that work at Lake Yale, from the manager on down to the maintenance people and those people that keep this beautiful yard. I think we ought to give Lake Yale a big hand. Thank you. I'm sorry for the interruption.
You can interrupt me most any time, Charlie. And have done so also. You know, there was a time in my life I used to stand on stage in front of a couple thousand people, and I'd be out there drunk, and I wasn't nervous. But I tell you what, I got the shakes this morning, and I know I'm among a bunch of people that love me. I'd like to open the meeting with a moment of silent meditation, please, and we'll follow it with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, and does not wish to engage in any controversy. It neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And that's what we're all about. And now I'd like to introduce to you the man who is my sponsor and who is one of the main reasons I'm here and who one of the main reasons why I'm alive, to read how it works. Woody, please.
Thank you, Jerry. You know, there's two requirements for staying around this program a long while. Just don't drink and keep breathing. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed their path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. That God could and would if he were sought. Thank you.
Thank you, buddy. Now I'd like to ask a friend of mine, Bev, to read the 12 traditions, please.
Hi, group. I'm Bev Haley, and I'm an alcoholic. I was just sitting up here thinking, my gosh, it wasn't too long ago that you wouldn't catch me in a church unless I was dead. But here, not too many years later, I'm sitting here and I'm enjoying it and I'm comfortable. And boy, the miracles that derive from being a member of this beautiful program. Please bear with me. They gave me this little card to read the traditions. And if I stumble, I'm sorry, but my eyes ain't like they used to be. 12 traditions of AA. Number one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. And eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. I've not met our speaker before or been around him to hear what he had to say, but I understand he is a terrific speaker and he sure could sing good, too, so I'd like to introduce you, Aubrey.
My name's Aubrey. I'm an alcoholic. I got a bunch of those victory drums going right now. It's always so easy to say yes when somebody asks you to talk, and it's a while off, you know. And then the time comes, you know. And I always get a little bit anxious. But I made a vow when I finally got sober, the day that I got sober, that I'd never turn down a request for any kind of help that I could possibly do. And I never pushed myself into a lot of situations, but I never turned anything down. If somebody asked me to talk, or it was all possible to sponsor anybody, and I didn't feel like I'd mess up their lives or something like that, and that sort of thing. I've tried to perform where I was asked, and that just doesn't go for AA, but for church too. But it was just a promise I made to my higher power when I got sober. And so I didn't want to say no to Charlie either. But I'm going to tell you how I feel. There's a lots of people out there in this room that I've heard talk. I feel kind of like if I was up trying to sing a solo and Pavarotti and Caruso was sitting out there in the audience, you know. All right, I'll tell you something happened to me not too long ago. I was playing golf, and I was just beginning to get my game down to where I was respectable. And the pro and two of his friends drove up and started following us around in their golf cart. And boy, did I tighten up. And that's sort of the way I am when I see Charlie and Bill and different ones out there in the audience that I've heard talk. Since I got in the program, several things have happened to me, some good and some bad, most of them good. But one of the things that's good is that I don't steal anymore. I don't steal money, and I don't steal clothes. But if I've ever heard you talk, and I've ever heard you come up with any kind of a good idea, I'll take it in a New York second. And I may or may not give you credit for it. And that depends altogether on how long I used it. And the way I work it is this. The first time I use it, I'll say as Charlie Lindenwood once said. And the second time I use it, I'll say as someone once said. And the third time, I'll say as I've always said. So, so you know by that just about how many times I've used any of these things. I made some notes for a couple of reasons. Not to make a long talk, but to try to keep it as short as I could. Because in an alcoholic's life, there are just a whole lot of things that can be told. My problem when I got into the program to start with was I was the youngest person in Savannah, Georgia, in that group, by 20-something years. And I was around there several years before anybody even came close to telling my story. People would walk up to me and say, "Oh, son, when I was your age, I was drinking 3/5 a day and working all the time, you know, supporting my family," or something like that. They were just the whole... It was just a different... Now, there are a lot of people coming in that are young and younger than I was. And so I try to tell my story as it happened, and hoping that it'll be something that somebody can identify with. Maybe not everybody, but maybe some of them. And the second reason I make these notes is that my memory is not as good as it used to be either. We have a family... kind of a family joke. It's a true story about a professor that mother had when she was in high school, and he came over to that house in Madison where my granddaddy was preaching at the time, and he came over there and a terrible storm broke out. Professor Peed was caught there at the house, and the storm just looked like it was going to last all night, so they prevailed on him to spend the night. And a little while later they missed him, and they looked all over the house for him, and he showed up on the front porch about 30 minutes later soaking wet in a puddle of water. He'd gone home to get his pajamas. And I'm not quite that bad yet. I'm not quite that bad yet, but I'm getting there. I managed to get through drinking with all but my wisdom teeth, and I feel grateful for that. And I took a lot of pride in my eyes until about 2 weeks ago. I was sitting at the Alcoan Club talking to Arnold, drinking a soda pop one afternoon, and I said, "Arnold, is a one-eyed brindle cat trying to get in that back door." Arnold said, "Aubrey," said, "that cat's got two good eyes and he's going out." See? When I made a talk a long time ago, they told me, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what kind of outline to use. And they just said, "Well, just tell everybody what it was like and your story, what it was like, and how you found AA and what it's been like since." And I never found an outline that worked any better than that. And so that's what I'm going to try to do today, is just tell you, starting out a little of my background. I grew up in a real good Christian home. I heard Father Hillary's tape one time, and on his tape he said, he'd heard so many alcoholics start out their talks that way that he wasn't too sure, even being a priest, that he wasn't too sure that was a good way to raise a child. He said, but I did. And we had nothing that I can remember except happiness. My dad was the first salesman for Scotch tape in the South, first one they ever hired. Back in the Depression days, and he had been an athlete at the University of Alabama with old Johnny Mac Brown, a cowboy movie star. My mother was a Methodist preacher's daughter, and my granddaddy, I was lucky enough to have him live with us for a few years after he retired. And we had nothing but love in our home. I have one sister that's never caused anybody a moment's problem. She's a program director for the Cerebral Palsy Center in Rome, Georgia. She took the job because her husband was in a tight, and she needed to go to work. But she stayed there because she loved those kids so much, and she's done it for about 20 years now. And she's a beautiful girl, and people will tell you in Rome that she's just pretty clean through. She never gave Mother and Dad any problems, and I didn't either until I was about 17. And I was, at that time, never thought about taking a drink. I never smoked a cigarette, took a drink, anything. I was an Eagle Scout. Got my Eagle Scout badge in a court of honor in Macon, Georgia. Robert L. Scott, that wrote God as my co-pilot, was from Macon, and he gave me that badge. He happened to be in town there. It was during World War II. And I still got a program signed by him. I was quarterback on a football team for 3 years and played on a basketball team and tennis team, and I was president of Methodist Youth Fellowship. Drinking was the furthest thing from my mind. And as I got to be a senior in high school, some of the other guys started going out to a beer joint. We're living in Forsyth, where I went to high school, up near Atlanta. And there was a beer joint between Forsyth and Barnesville that sell teenagers a beer, or Ace High Wine, a little thing that came in a 7-Up bottle. We'd go out there sometime and just take a sip. And I seemed to like it more than anybody else did. It seemed to do something for me. It sort of made me one of the people, one of the gang. I had moved several times when growing up. And every time I'd move, I'd leave old friends, and I'd have to get to town and make new friends. And acceptance was a big thing for me. I really wanted to be close to people. And this drinking thing made me feel close to these guys and gals that we'd go out there. I really felt warm toward them. And I felt like they felt that way toward me. It went through me about like a forest fire. Right that next year, I had a scholarship in music and one in football. But by the time I got to college, I didn't want to do much of anything but drink. And I remember writing my daddy, he'd always wanted me to play college ball, and I remember I got a slight injury, nothing bad. We'd been down to Douglas playing South Georgia College. People here from Douglas, and I came back, and the next week in practice got a slight concussion. Well, anything bad of the GMC then. Well, Ennis went, I think Ennis went there too. Before I did, it wasn't anything bad. But I remember writing my dad a letter telling him that I was hurt and couldn't play no more ball because I wanted to keep on sneaking out of study hall to this beer joint out the road. That was the end of my career, except for talking about it. As far as the music, I went ahead and decided to pursue because musicians all drank, and that was a good environment for me to get in to be where there was drinking, because there was easy drinking and it was not any frowning on it. My mother and dad frowned on drinking, mother being a preacher's daughter. And dad had had a slight problem with it himself, and she straightened him out pretty well. So we didn't, we didn't have any in our home or anything like that. So that was the situation as far as I was concerned. So by that time, I was developing a strong resentment against my parents. Why don't they leave me alone and let me live like I want to live? You know, that sort of thing. I guess y'all have been through that same sort of thing. Then I got a resentment against the church. I said, boy, all my life, they shined me up and polished me up and shoved me through the doors every time it opened. And now that I'm old enough, I ain't ever going again. And I didn't accept that I had jobs in church choirs. They would pay a lead in each section, and I could make spending money. I transferred down to Armstrong College in Savannah, and I could make singing in the First Baptist Choir or Independent Presbyterian. I could make spending money. But I made up my mind. I said, well, even though I'm going there and singing in the choir, I ain't going to listen to the sermon. And I just developed a real strong resentment toward anything that had any kind of authority. And all this, I didn't realize what was happening to me. I thought I was just growing up. I felt like, well, I've been repressed. They've told me what to do. I've grown up with all these inhibitions and everything like that. And they would say things to me like, you know, well, your drinking doesn't make sense. And I'd think to myself, well, you know, the world don't make sense. I pick up the paper and read it. It don't make sense. I listen to my parents' advice and other people, and it doesn't make sense. But when I take a drink, everything just seems to make sense. And better sense than anything else. So then I started looking for places that I could drink. And I started, I think that's one of the reasons I got in sales. Harry G. up in Jacksonville, I think the world of. And Harry used to make a talk, and Harry's an engineer. And Harry would talk about how drinking started out on the periphery of his life. It was something that just went along with football games and dances. If they happened to go to a football game, somebody had a bottle, they took a drink. If they happened to go to a dance and somebody had a bottle, they took a drink. But gradually, it just worked its way more into the center of his life. And the point, and I got that way. I wouldn't go to a football game with you if you didn't have liquor. I wouldn't go to a dance unless there was going to be liquor. I picked my friends on whether they drank. And I picked my jobs, where I worked, by whether or not I could drink. And that's one of the reasons I think that I got into sales, is because I was outside traveling and nobody could really watch me that close. The only problem was that when I drank, I didn't work. I'd gotten to the point where I didn't really work that much. And I went through two or three jobs that I'd gotten through family connections and other things. I actually worked for my dad and my uncle for a while. They'd gone into business in Savannah. That didn't work out, and I blamed it on the town, on the area. And that was when I started some of my geographical cures. I went up to New York. I said, well, I need to get up there. I want to go up there and study music. Well, I went up to New York, and for years after I came back, I'd tell everybody all the stuff that I did up there and the auditions I had and all the people I met, and I could name drop this sort of thing. Actually, the whole truth of the matter was I stayed drunk up there for about 2 years, and the only singing I did was in little piano bars where I sang for drinks. I had several chances to go and audition for different things, but I never went because I was partying and I wanted to feel like getting up the next day. It was just a good excuse to go and drink. And when I got back home, when I had to come, I was the biggest mess anybody ever saw. And by then, my parents had realized that, well, there's something really wrong. And they sent me to a psychiatrist. And a psychiatrist asked me the classic question, you know, how much do you drink? And I gave him the classic answer, you know, with a couple of beers. And he asked me why I drank. And I told him that I just, that there was not really anything else to do. That my friends drank, and we just sat around. We liked to drink in the afternoons, different bars and things like that. And he said, well, have you ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I told him I'd read something about it, and I saw a movie once with something in it. And he gave me the address and recommended that I go. I didn't know what AA was. I had no idea exactly what it was. What I thought it was, he said it was for people who drink a lot, drink too much, who are alcoholics. And they help each other. Well, I had it pictured in my mind that it was a group of people that all drank too much. And half of them stayed sober while the other half drank. And then that half stayed sober while the other half drank. And they looked out for each other. And I thought, well, I'm not having a whole lot of success on my own. I think I'll go up there and try that. Just join up with that and see if that system works. The memory that I have of AA was laughter. I opened that door, and I heard people laughing. I had never heard laughter like that except around the bar. After somebody had gotten off a good joke or played a joke on somebody else or told a off-color joke or something like that. It was just this belly laughter, peals of laughter coming down the stairs. My first thought was they started without me. I'm too late. And I got up those stairs, and it wasn't a drink in sight anywhere. It was a coffee. And I thought maybe they're putting something in the coffee. I hung around, And nobody had come with me. I didn't have a sponsor. I just had the address given to me by this psychiatrist. And I sat around and I listened. Well, for years, I had thought that I was crazy. I had thought that I was insane, and I had been pushed into two or three sobering up places and one thing or the other, and I had had things happen to me. I had become more and more secretive about how much I drank. I knew, I guess subconsciously, that I was drinking more than anybody else, too much, and I was hiding it. And as a consequence, I didn't really know some of the things that happened to you when you drank, and I didn't know what caused them. Well, I was in Richmond, Virginia, when I was working up there for Southern Cotton Oil, and I was in the old Richmond Hotel, and this had happened several years before I went to AA. I had fallen in love with a girl that was a real Christian girl, and I was trying to quit drinking. And I just cut off completely, which I still could do at that time. And about 3 days after I cut off completely, I was getting ready to go to sleep in the motel room, and I turned the light off. And a few minutes later, I saw the adjoining door open and something come through it. I turned the light back on. There was nothing there. And I turned it off again, and I saw the door open and something come through it again. This went on and off for about 30 or 40 minutes. I just almost pulled that chain out, turned it on and off. And I figured, well, the devil's after me. My religious upbringing and everything, come, the devil's after me. And if I turn that light out, he's going to get me. And I got up and dug through every drawer in that place until I finally found a Gideon Bible, and I read it all night. It wasn't until that 3 years later when I went to AA, I was sitting around drinking coffee, which I didn't really want to drink, but there's nothing else to drink. And I was listening to two fellers talk about a drunk. One of them was on up in Charleston a couple of years before, and how he had woke up and saw these four cannibals sitting on the bedpost. And one of them was trying to bite his foot. And I thought to myself, I said, boy, this guy... And I kept listening more and more and more. And after I put it all together, I said, well, what was the matter? And he said, it was just the whim-whims. He said, that happens to you when you cut off the drinking too quick. And so I said, well, I knew this fellow one time is up in Richmond. And told him that story. He said, that's all he had. Said he just cut off the drinking real quick like that. He said, that happens to people. Well, I began, I knew so little about it. I was an alcoholic, and I didn't even know the least little things about it. But that was the greatest relief to me. Can you imagine to be relieved that you were an alcoholic? Because I was afraid that I was crazy. I stayed around there for a while. I never really felt like that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I just couldn't get that through my mind. And I couldn't find, like I say, anybody to relate to. So I was going in and out of AA a good bit. I'm not proud of it. But drinking was so necessary to me. I had so many personality defects that any time somebody would come up with the slightest thing that I thought might work for me, I'd try it. I know I'd been sober about 2 months one time, and I'm on the street, walking down the street, and a bartender that I knew came up. He said, how are you doing? I said, oh, I'm doing pretty good. He said, I'm seeing you lately. I said, well, I've been drinking lately. He said, why? I said, well, you know, I always get too much. He said, you know your trouble? I said, you drink too fast. I said, you drink out of those small glasses. He said, you should drink out of a tall glass. He said, just don't drink so fast. He said, next time you come in there, he says, I got some tall glasses. I just start serving you those. Well, I tried the tall glasses. Another guy said, well, if you line your stomach with some olive oil, you know. I tried that. Another guy said, well, just try some white rice. You know, soak up that stuff before it hits your brain. I went through a series of this sort of thing. I guess the worst thing I went through was that I rationalized around and I said, well, you know, if I could ever get back in shape. I'd been in the Army. I was a PT and drill instructor at OCS. And I'd give 4 or 5 hours of calisthenics every day out of Fort Riley in about 110 degrees heat. But I could drink all night, part of the next day, you know, and just never seemed to feel it. So I said, if I could just get back in shape. I had a good job and had made good money the year before. And I quit it to take a job over here in Daytona Beach teaching swimming at the YMCA. And I set myself a 3 month program of getting back in shape. And in between these swimming classes, when I teach these kids, I go up and lift weights and run a track. I went to AA every day to be sure that I could complete this three-month program. And at the end of that 3 months, I was stronger than I had ever been in my life. I mean, I could lift more weights and more repetitions, and I was full of vitamins. I was full of vim and vigor. And I had a place picked out over in Daytona Beach where I was going to go drink socially. And I even got a clean suit and a new tie. And went over there that night, and I had seen people come in bars and order a martini and ask for a menu at the same time. And while they were sipping the martini, they ordered a steak, and by the time the steak got there, they went ahead and had the steak, and that was the way they drank, gentlemanly. And I ordered a martini and asked for the menu. 10:30 that night, I'm still drinking martinis. I hadn't ordered anything. And 3 days later, as strong as I'd been, it took two guys come in from the hospital, lifted me off the bed, put me on a stretcher, and took me into the drying out spot. So I gave it a good shot. Mother and Dad were footing the bill for a lot of hospitals. They, every time they heard of a place that they thought could get me straightened out, they'd send me. And they would send me even one time to Silver Hill. That's the place where Joan Kennedy went to Silver Hill. She was there a lot, many years after I was there. But I mean, it was a really expensive place up in New Canaan, Connecticut. And I went up there and stayed 3 months. And at the end of that 3 months, they said, well, you've been operating on a real fast track. You need to get somewhere it's slow. So we've got a former patient that's got a fish camp up in Canada. And said, we'd like you to go up there and just work for him up there for a while. So where things are slow. For about a year, said, that'd probably straighten you out. And I left the place after 3 months of real expensive therapy and treatment and went down to New York City and got a job on Madison Avenue with an ad agency. That lasted about 2 weeks. It was an environment in which people were drinking at 10, 11 in the morning, and, you know. So that's about as much as I'm going to get into as far as the drunkalogue. I'm just telling you some of the things I went through. I tried every way in the world to drink that I could possibly think of. And my mother and dad tried every way in the world to get me sober through all the treatment centers and everything like that. None of them worked. Finally, I decided, well, you know, if I get married, maybe that would. I spent a lot of time chasing girls, and you have to chase them in bars. I believe if I got married, I wouldn't have to do that. That might help. So I got married, and that didn't seem to solve it either. And by that time, Mother and Dad had spent all the money they could spend. They were about broke. I had gotten down to the point where I didn't have any money. I had had to take my wife and little girl back to her parents. And I was down in St. Petersburg, Florida, out of jail on a fourth DUI bond. I thought I'd lost my job. My landlady was getting ready to throw me in jail for defrauding an innkeeper, 2 months behind in the rent. And at the end of my rope, Mother and Dad didn't have any. I had about $15 in my pocket, and there was a liquor store across the street. On a Saturday, a Sunday night, it was still open though. And I thought seriously about going over there and getting a bottle. And then I don't know what it was. There was something there that just told me that I was really at a crossroads. That I'd been lucky so far, but one way this crossroad lay some kind of sobriety, if I could get it, and the other way were the asylums and the jails and the things, the yes that they told me about. So I called AA. AA had been coming to help me for many years, never failed to come help me until that night. And that guy didn't come. And I'm sitting there, and that neon sign is blinking over there, and I've got that money, and I've got the shakes. And I thought, maybe, this thing would work. I had always been afraid to turn my will and life over to the care of God. Growing up in a religious home with ministers in it, missionaries in my background, I couldn't conceive of anything except a full-time Christian commitment. If I turn my will and life to God, I'm going to be on the next boat to the next leper colony in Africa, you know, just as sure as I do it. Or are they going to have me down on the street corner beating a drum and all my friends coming by and laughing? And this was the sort of things that would go into my mind when I think about doing that third step or really getting fully into the program. But I didn't have any other way to turn. And I remember pitching forward on my face. Didn't even get on my knees. And I remembered saying, God, if you'll give me back the peace that I had when I was a boy and take away this compulsion to drink, I'll do anything you want me to. And I'm going to stay here till I get some relief. And I stayed there for probably 20, 30 minutes, and then I drug myself to my knees by my bed, and I stayed there for an hour or two. And something came over me. I don't know what it was, but it was like cold water. And a feeling of relief that everything was going to be all right. I didn't know how. I hadn't sobered up in years without a doctor, without pills, without medicine. But that night I went to bed and I slept like a baby. And the next morning there was a knock on the door. A man standing out there, a nice looking man. He said, I'm from AA. He said, you know, he said, last night, he said, we misplaced your message. We want to really apologize. But said, is there anything we can do to help you? Well, my car was in the pound. My check was down in Bradenton. And he helped me iron out some of those things. That was on August the 8th, 1963. And I haven't had a desire to drink. God lifted that desire from me then, and I haven't had it since. I've been in AA since that time. I've been happy in AA most of the time, particularly lately. There's been a growing process with me. I've had some trauma in my life. I've had some things happen. I've had some things that some people say, well, you know, they're bad things. You know, those shouldn't happen to you if you're sober. Well, there's no reason why bad things can't happen to you sober. I mean, why not? But the thing about it is that the program works. It works to get you through it. I think the thing that I've learned the most from the program lately, in the last few years, is I've finally learned how to live 24 hours at a time. The first 20 years I was sober, I had been too much of a worrier most of my life. I was a conscientious worrier. I mean, I was the kind of worrier that if there was something to be worried about, I felt guilty if I didn't worry it out until I came up with all the possible solutions. And even though I was staying sober, and even though that I was staying sober a day at a time and not drinking a day at a time, I wasn't really getting the full joy and freedom from the program that I got once I learned how to live every day at a time. And this all came about to me after I moved to Orlando. I moved down here about 3 years ago. And even though I'd been sober a long time, I hadn't been associated with people like the ones in Orlando. And I hadn't been in discussion groups like they had in Orlando. And Bill Oakley gave me a book called New Pair of Glasses, the Chuck Chamberlain's book. And in there, Chuck Chamberlain said, it's my job to do God's work. It's God's job to take care of me. And I began to think about that. And I realized that I hadn't been active enough in the service end of the program and helping other people enough and things like this. He also said in that same book to this group of people that he was talking to, he said, don't tell me what you know. Tell me how you feel. And I got to thinking about that. I had never told anybody how I really felt. I grew up in a stiff upper lip type environment, you know. And playing ball, somebody would say, boy, is your leg hurt? No, I don't hurt, you know, that sort of thing. And I carried that all the way through in my life. I could be dying inside and somebody would say, how's everything today? Oh, everything's fine. Great. You know? Well, how's anybody going to help you if they don't know you're hurting? And I learned to share in those rooms down there at Alcalan and up at Winter Park and some of the other meetings I went to. And I learned that people weren't going to think you were a sissy or they weren't going to think you were weak just because you had problems, just because you had things that were bothering you. I heard Bill say this, too. I'm giving him too much credit this morning. I heard him say that this is a program of nodders. I don't care what you say in a discussion meeting. Hey, somebody around that room is going to be nodding their head. At least one person. I never saw in any of those discussion groups anybody, I never saw the whole room get up and applaud or anything anybody said. I never seen them get up and walk out in disgust either. But people were sharing. And I learned to share. And that was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. I also learned the many, many things that I have to be grateful for. And I went back and I started counting the blessings, starting back in St. Petersburg. I was listening. A lot of people malign these TV preachers, but I've gotten a lot of good out of listening to them at times, too. And one time I was listening to one of them, and an old missionary was on there that had been many, many years overseas somewhere. And they asked him what he did sometime when he got real depressed. And he said, well, I look in the scriptures. And they said, well, they don't make sense, what do you do? He said, oh, well, he says, then I pray. They said, well, what if your prayers are just bouncing off the ceiling? He said, then I look back to the last time that I had a miracle happen in my life, or the last time that I know that I had a prayer answer. And I just start from there. And so that's what I've done a lot of times. I go back to the night in St. Petersburg, and God took that desire away, and I start from there, and I count my blessings, and I've come to find a great thing, that Bill Wilson was right when he said, God is a kind, loving God, that he's not going to give you anything that's bad for you. He's a much better parent than I ever was. I used to give my kids everything they asked for. God only gives you what's good for you. I had, I don't know, I have so many blessings so many things in my life right now, so many things that I'm happy about right now, that I look back to that second meeting I went to in AA in Savannah, and there was a guy that got up there one time, and he says, "I'm glad I'm an alcoholic." Well, that club was right there at the intersection of Liberty and Abercorn, right down the street from the Sapphire Room, right down the street from the Drayton Arms Lounge, right on the main drag. There was all kind of bars open in that town, all kind of poker games, all kind of action going on. I was sitting up there in that old room with those old people, and he's saying he's glad he's an alcoholic. And I thought he's crazy. But now I know what he's talking about. Because if it took being an alcoholic with all the traumas to lead me to the kind and loving God that I've found in AA, and to lead me to the friends that I've had in AA. You know, I found an unconditional love in AA. I never found that hardly anywhere else except from my parents or except from people who were really in tune with spiritual things. Most of the time, love is what people call love is more approval than it is love. You know, you do what I want you to and I love you, or something like that, you know. In AA, people can know the very worst about you and still love you. That's what always happened to me. They never gave up on me. None of the people that I ever knew ever gave up on me. Even though I had enough white chips to pave a driveway, they kept coming. They kept coming. It was just unconditional because it came straight from God, a kind and loving God. They had that spirit in them. And that's what I feel here. Last night when Charlie said everybody turn around and say they love each other to the people next to them, there was a lot of sincerity in this room, a lot of love that I could feel, that I could really feel, a lot of genuine concern, not this phony stuff that you run into so much. This was a real genuine concern for each other. This is the first time I've been here, but I tell you, if I live, it ain't going to be the last. I really have enjoyed being here. There's a thing I want to read to you before I leave that sort of embodies the sort of feeling I have right now, more than anything else, and I'm going to close with that. James W. Foley wrote a poem called A Tale of the Trail. And it goes like this. It ain't so far from right to wrong. The trail ain't hard to lose. Sometimes I'd almost give my horse to know one to choose. There ain't no signboards on the way to keep you on the track. Sometimes wrong looks as white as the driven snow, and right looks awfully black. I don't set up to be a judge of right and wrong in men. I've lost the trail sometimes myself, and I may get lost again. But when I see someone who looks as though they've gone astray, I want to shove my hand in theirs and help them find the way. Thank you.
Fine message. Thank you. Charlie, was there anything else you had? Any announcements or anything? Fabulous. Fabulous. Let's hope the lady that, or the person that lost her gold bracelet finds it, or if it's already been turned in. And we have a beautiful... we have a beautiful way of closing with the Lord's Prayer.